Hey folks, and welcome back to the Evil Dungeon Master Universe podcast. And as you can see, this is going to be an interview that I had done in the past with Buzz Dixon. If you're not familiar with Buzz Dixon, you probably watched one of the various many shows or cartoons that he wrote for back in the 80s, such as G.I. Joe, Transformers, Dungeons and Dragons cartoon. And this one really focuses on the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, G.I. Joe. So I had a chance to interview him a couple years ago. I wanted to move it over here to this podcast because it was a solo interview, and I wanted to save it for prosperity before the RFI podcast actually goes away. So enjoy the interview with Buzz Dixon. It's a longer episode today, but hopefully you'll enjoy it. And don't forget, ask the DM at theevildm.com and theevildm.com for the Evil Dungeon Master Universe podcast. Hope you have a great day and a great And you had a great weekend. Thanks. Bye.
Buzz Dixon. Buzz, how are you this evening?
I am very well. Thank you very much, Vince.
I appreciate you coming on the podcast. After we've been reviewing the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, your name came up. I've heard you on many podcasts, and just getting to speak to you is amazing. You know, get that whole fanboy aspect out of the way on the air here, get the embarrassment done. I mean, you formulated all the cartoons that I, you know, my childhood is based around the stuff that you wrote, I watched, and went, oh my God. So, you know. I praise
yeah,
you.
I thank you very much. I mean, as I said, you know, I think I got the better part of the deal because I ended up getting a career out of it, and it was all thanks to people enjoying my work. So I thank you guys, my fans and the viewers. And as for the fanboy part of it, I met Jack Kirby working at Ruby Spears before I went over to work on the Dungeons and Dragons show. And we had been developing a show, Thundar the Barbarian, for Ruby Spears. And Steve Gerber, who was you know, the creator of Howard the Duck, but he had left comics and he was working in animation at that point. Steve said he knew an artist that he was going to bring in. Mm-hmm. And we had our first production meeting, you know, all the writers and artists and whatnot, first production meeting on Thundar. And I came into the room a little early, and I saw John Dorman, who was the head of the storyboard department, talking to this older guy. And, you know, John didn't introduce me to the other guy, and I just sat down, and, you know, we started chatting. And the old guy, I mean, he was just, you've heard the expression of twinkle in somebody's eye. This is the only person who I've ever met whose eyes literally twinkled.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, he was just bright. He was funny. He was on the ball. And, you know, we struck it off really well. And as people started drifting into the room one by one, nobody made any introductions. Everybody assumed everybody knew everybody else. Hmm. So we have the first production meeting. We start talking about Thundar. We start kicking ideas around. And the old guy was just incredible. He'd take an idea and he'd turn it this way and that. And he'd say, well, we could do this thing and that thing. And he would take a little idea and turn it into a big one. And I'm sitting there going, wow, this guy's really good. I'm looking forward to working with him, you know. Yeah. And as I said, we were hitting it off really well. We were getting along with each other. It was clear we were going to enjoy working together. And after the meeting, he said, well, I'll go back to my studio and I'll draw up some of these concepts. And, you know, we, the writers, were going to go off and start developing story ideas. And I went into Steve Gerber's office and I said, yeah, I'm really looking forward to working on Thundar. But tell me, who was the old guy in the room?
Oh, God.
And he said, that was Jack Kirby. And my reaction was like, I was just floor. I mean, that was Jack Kirby? And if I had known it was Jack Kirby, I mean, I would have not been able to function in the meeting at all. I would have just been, you know, just awestruck. But, you know, like I tell people, I was friends with Jack Kirby before I knew he was Jack Kirby.
Wow. Yeah, and you didn't even know it.
Yeah.
Well, so getting into, I asked the community a bunch of questions here, and we kind of went over them before the show, and you approved them, so we can go over these questions. But I think that, like, the first question would really that stands out in my mind is, how did you get attached to this project, and how did you meet Gary Gygax himself? Let's start the origin there.
Well, it comes in from two different angles.
Okay.
We have the Flint Dilly angle and the Steve Gerber angle. And Flint and if all of them, I met Steve first at Ruby Spears. I was working as a staff writer. Steve was brought in as a story editor. We hit it off really well. We became really good, close friends. A couple of years after that, Flint Dilley was added to the staff. He came on. Again, we struck it off well, you know, became good friends. The three of us had, we called it the Vietnam War of dinner parties one night. We went out at like 6 o'clock to have dinner. And I will curtail the exact series of events, but it was like 4 a.m. when we finally got back in. So, you know, we hung around. We were friends. We did stuff together. Anyway, Steve developed Thundar, co-developed Thundar for television. And after he left Ruby Spears, he was snatched up by the people that were doing Dungeons & Dragons. He went over there. He was the story editor. And he called me up because he knew, well, Buzz, you do this, you know, action adventure stuff really well. You come over here and you know, develop an idea for us, which Quest of the Skeleton Warrior was the script I did for them.
Right.
Conversely, Flint knew Gary Gygax personally. Flint had worked with TSR, had developed things for him, and he and Gary hung out a lot. And on more than one occasion, Flint and I went up to Gary Gygax's house and hung out with him, and you know, talks, played D&D games, did G.I. Joe simulations and whatnot. Gygax had this house in the Hollywood Hills that overlooked the Westwood area. Westwood would be west of Hollywood, Los Angeles. It's between Hollywood and the ocean, basically.
Right.
And he had this house that overlooked Westwood. I mean, this was like something out of a 1960s James Bond movie. I'm not kidding you.
Oh, wow.
Big, huge windows. It's overlooking the city. There was a gatekeeper house, because this house was old. This was like classic Hollywood-era house. And so there was like a gatekeeper's house, because back in the old days, they actually had employees living in the gatekeeper's house to make sure people didn't just come driving up. And the gatekeeper's house had been turned into this elaborate D&D play area. They had this huge sand table. And I mean, when I say huge, you could not reach across it.
You
had to physically walk around it if you wanted to maneuver stuff on it. And it was filled with sand, and they would sculpt the sand into terrain. They'd add trees, they'd add buildings, they'd bring in the figures and whatnot. And they would play D&D games, you know, hours on end.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it is what people do now on a much smaller scale. The you know, printed 3D, what do you call them?
Tile maps.
Sets, tiles. That's it. Tiles. Yeah. The printed 3D tiles and the walls and stuff like that. Gygax had this stuff much bigger, much more elaborate, and much larger. And he was a nice guy. I mean, he was. It was always, you know, fun to be, you know, up there and talk with people. And he had a constantly. It was kind of like the Playboy Mansion, only instead of bunnies, it was all gamers. You know, guys coming in and out, and people that were developing games and developing new concepts and stuff like this. And, you know, I remember going up there one time, and I will not mention the lawyer's name because I don't want anybody to come after me. But I go up there one time, and there's like one of the most high-powered lawyers in Hollywood just swimming in Gary's pool. He just came up and was hanging out for the afternoon, and here he is enjoying, you know, a dip in Gary's pool. So, you know, you can literally bump into anybody up there.
Wow.
He had in the kitchen, I mean, this literally professional-sized kitchen. He had a full-time staff on there. And the refrigerators were like the refrigerators you find in a 7-Eleven or something, you know, glass front with big, deep counters, supermarket-type things, you know. And you could just look at stuff, and whatever you'd want, you'd say, well, you know, wow, I'd really like to have an omelet. And the cook would go, absolutely, and fix one up for you. So Gary lived well, I'll say that.
So he was like the Hugh Hefner of D&D kind of thing.
Hugh Hefner of D&D, yeah. I mean, and I would be very honest, and I would say he probably had a better life than you did, because you know, if you're 80 years old and you're still putzing around with D&D figures, people go, well, that's kind of a charming hobby. If you're still putzing around with teenage women, you know, it's a little creepy. Okay?
Yeah, true. Very true. Wow. All right. So you worked on the project with Flint Dilley, who is the brother to Lorraine Williams, if I'm correct, right?
Yes. Lorraine. Yes.
Was the president of TSR at the time while you were out there in California. So in case people were wondering where Flint comes along and how the relationship was there. Some people do know that, some people don't. So just wanted to make note of that.
Yeah.
So you worked over there. Okay, great. So you started working. They brought you in to write the quest for the Skeletal Warrior, which obviously was one of the better written ones out there of the whole series.
Thank you.
It made sense and it was well put together. And we just got done reviewing that one, so we had some good praise about that and how it was written, how the characters the way they were communicating and came across better than a lot of times in the series. So it's like you knew the characters really well. But you didn't invent these characters, as you said before the show. You came on after the Bible was already written for the show.
Right. I am pretty certain Steve, if he did not do all the development, did the lion's share of the development, I'm sure he crafted the final, you know, approach of the characters and how they were handled. And when Steve asked me if I wanted to do something for the show, I told him, I said, one of the things that had frustrated me about Thundar was, as much fun as it was doing Thundar, everything was a very simplistic black and white morality.
Yeah.
Thundar and his allies are always the good guys. The evil people are always evil, you know, irredeemably evil. And I said, I want to do a story where we've got a sympathetic bad guy, somebody that we can look at him and go, well, I understand why he's doing it. You know, not just he's evil for the sake of being evil. And as we were talking about it, and you know, Steve was mentioning the various classes of warriors and villains that had been approved for the show, because, you know, they were going through the, you know, whole menagerie that D&D had created. And some of the concepts were being withheld because they were, you know, frankly too difficult to animate, you know, and they just say, well, we can't do that one, but, you know, this kind is okay to do. And the skeleton warriors that they came up with, I said, yeah, I like that, because I like the idea that we have somebody who was once a human being, once, you know, flesh and blood, has now been reduced to this skeletal status, and he wants to get back to where he was. And that's a perfectly logical and believable motivation for anybody. You can be a hero and want to do that. And the fact that he's a villain is just showing that he is so desperate, he is for the wrong side in an effort to restore himself to what he once was. Steve liked that, and as we started working more into the show, I realized we were limited in the kind of threat that we could present to the kids in the show, because, you know, you can't, at that time in Saturday morning television, you could not threaten anybody, much less a child, with serious bodily harm.
Right.
But it dawned on me. I said, well, what we can do is we can find what every kid is afraid of, every kid in the series is afraid of, and we can emphasize that. We can show them being made afraid of that thing. And then that way the kids will understand it. They'll grasp, you know, even if we can't threaten them with life and death, they'll grasp, oh, well, yeah, I don't want anybody to treat me like a little baby. I would hate, you know, if everybody thought I was a little baby. Or conversely, I don't want to get old. I don't want to get wrinkly and arthritic and things like this. Mm. And I approached every character. I thought, well, what is their defining characteristic? What's their defining trait? What's their weakness? And then that would be what I would focus on. That's what Dekian and I'm trying to remember the name of the chief bad guy now.
Venger?
Drawing a blank. Sorry.
Did you
Yeah,
mean, okay.
that's what they would be trying to capitalize on. That's what they would be trying to exploit. And so once that came along, then the rest of it was fairly easy to write. You do your setup, you put your characters in, have them strong.
Cool. Sorry, you broke up there for a second, so that's why I didn't hear anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Well, I was just saying that you know, once you know what motivates your characters, Kurt Vonnegut has, and you can find this online, anybody who searches, you know, for a few moments will find Vonnegut's guidelines or rules for writing a story. And one of the most important rules is everybody in the story wants something. Even if it's a walk-on character and all they want is a glass of water, they want something. And so every character in your story has to want something. And what I was doing here, without getting, you know, too artsy-fartsy about it, is I just said, well, what does everybody want? And the moment you figure out what they want, then you know what will motivate them. And then at that point, you've got your conflict. And once you have your conflict, you have your story.
I noticed on that episode with Hank melting, how did you get that one past the Saturday morning censors? Because that was pretty, I don't know, I thought that was kind of graphic for a little kid. I remember seeing that and I was like, holy crap. But I mean,
we were allowed certain magical perils that could not happen in real life.
Right.
For example, I mean, going back to Thundar, Thundar has this sun sword and he could not chop a person with it.
No.
Because, you know, a kid can conceivably find a knife in, you know, the kitchen drawer and whack off, you know, brother's ear with it or something like that. But he could take the sun sword and he could defeat a clay monster with it. Because the clay monster is clearly, there are no clay monsters and it's not alive, it's just a lump of mud. Okay, fine. And that was the rationale that the networks had at the time. As long as it was not, quote, imitatable violence, unquote, you could do it. So if I were to take Hank, if you know, somebody were to grab Hank by the throat and start choking him, no, you can't do that. A little kid could run out and choke somebody. You zap him with a magic spell that starts him to melt. Well, you know, most kids don't have access to magic spells, so, you know, it's okay, you can do that.
Yeah, they'll just go, oh, I'm melting, and fall to the ground or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Something harmless like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, yeah, because we were wondering that as we were reviewing, like, wow, I wonder how they got that past, and that explains that.
It's weird, because the weirder and more complicated the thing was, the more graphic you could depict something. I mean, you could say, oh, well, he's going to turn Thundar inside out, and have little blue flowers popping out all over him. Yeah, okay, fine, do that, you know. Well, geez, it's rather gruesome looking. Yeah, but the kids can't do it, so go ahead.
So whenever you wrote these things, you had to approach it from the fact of how would a kid look at this, and could a kid actually mimic this, and would he mimic it? So that's when you wrote things, you had to think that way, is what you're saying.
We had to think, it was actually one step more than that.
Oh.
We had to say, what does the network think a kid will think and
oh,
do
boy.
That
yeah
because we had I mean, you know, we're doing this stuff and we're going, you know, we were kids, you know, we were 6 year olds, we were 8 year olds, we know that this isn't real, we know it's all make-believe.
Yeah,
but you know, the networks assumed that the kids assumed everything was literally true, everything would literally happen. So you'd have to look at something and go, well, all right, If I want somebody to threaten them with this, the network would say, well, that's too imitatable. So I have to come up with something that the network would say, okay. Let me give you an idea of just how silly this got. Okay, we developed a show, never got animated, never got into the production phase, but we developed a show. Steve Gerber, myself, Marty Pasco, and Jack Kirby, among others.
Oh, wow.
Called Roxy's Raiders. And it was basically a ripoff of Raiders of the Lost Ark. It was about a teenage girl who ran a circus, and basically all the guys in the sideshow were like her co-adventurers. So if you could imagine Lara Croft with Doc Savage's crew, only Doc Savage's crew was made up of spirits. That's what Roxy's Rangers was all about. Okay? So that gives you an idea of what we were going for. And in the pilot episode, Roxy and one of the other characters are tied to stakes in a chamber that is waist deep in water. Okay?
Okay.
And the bad guy opens up a grating, and two large moray eels swim out and start swimming towards them. And, you know, standard old movie serial type stuff, okay?
All right.
The network came back and said, you can't do that. You have to have a big rock between Roxy and the eels. And it's got to be big enough that the eels don't see Roxy when they come out. Because if the guy releases the eels and they can see Roxy, then he's trying to hurt Roxy. But if he releases the eels and the eels first have to swim around the rock in order to see Roxy, then he's not deliberately releasing them to attack Roxy. And I forget exactly what our reactions were, but it was all on the lines of, you have got to be blanking kidding me.
That's absolutely silly. I mean, come on. But
I mean, it's like, this is the most ridiculous thing, you know, that we've heard this week. I didn't say ever. I mean, just that week. But
just the week.
I mean, that was the type of thinking that people did at that time. And, you know, you had to anticipate what the network objections would be and what they would accept and what they wouldn't accept.
So was it true that a lot of things that you had written where you tried to write things in really, like, extreme to get the things that you wanted to go in so they would bypass? They say, hey, take that out. Oh, this isn't so bad compared to that type deal?
It happened. It varied, you know, from show to show.
Right.
The first year that we had Thundar the Barbarian out, it was a big hit.
Yeah.
And we were renewed, but a lot of people noticed just how violent it was. But it's all magic violent, you know, sci-fi violence. It was the last. And the network indicated, well, we're gonna trim it down for the next season. And Joe Ruby, our producer, said, well, geez, you know, they were already breathing down our necks in the first season. They're gonna trim it down even more. What are we gonna do? And I said, what we have to do is write the single most violent script we can possibly come up with and send it to them. And then when they cut it down, they will still leave in enough stuff that in the future, if we want to do something, we can always point back to the censored version and say, well, hey, you let us do it in the pilot. Joe said, who's gonna write the season opener then? And every eye in the room turned towards me. So I wrote this episode called Wizard War, and I pulled out all the stops. I was dropping robots into big ducted fan blades, and they were being sliced to ribbons, parts splattered all over the place. I mean, I just went completely crazy. It was all sci-fi fantasy violence, never hurting a living thing, but I pulled all the stops out. And I mean, Joe read it and turned green and said, my God, we can't send this to them. And he trimmed it and he sent it to the network, and the network screamed and went through it and marked it out, and then sent it back. But even their censored version still had a lot of action and adventure in it. And we were able to keep the level of the show, you know, as high for the second season. The payoff to the story is I found out later that for the next 17 years, I was the official bad example at ABC Program Practices. That's their censor department. And every time they were hiring a new person in Program Practices, they would give him a copy or her a copy of my script. And if they couldn't find at least 50 things wrong with it, they didn't get the job.
Nice. So you were the standards.
I was the standard. I was the one that, you know, if give them this and see how they react to it. And if they don't react strongly enough, they don't work here.
Okay, cool. Let me go on to the next question here for you. Tom wants to know, why an amusement park ride to transport the kids to the other realm? What did you know why they picked that?
I haven't the faintest idea. I'll be very honest with you. I am somebody with a little bit of clout at some point in the process said, wow, you know, and they could go there by going through a magical amusement park ride. And somebody else recognized, well, you know, if we give them this one, they'll be more open to ideas from us. So they said, yeah, of course. That's a great idea. Let's put them on an amusement park ride. Because, I mean, you know, outside of the opening credits, we never come back to them.
We never.
You know, it's they could have been playing the game. They could have been on pogo sticks. They could have been riding in an airplane. It doesn't matter. All that matters is once they get there, what happens next.
True. How involved was Gary with the whole production that you recall? Was he there in the writing meetings, or did he just like look things over and give a nod, or what did Gary? How was his involvement?
I think Gary at that point recognized this particular property was a subset of the much larger D&D universe.
Right.
And he recognized it as not crucial to the future of TSR and the future of Dungeons and Dragons. And to this degree, he was absolutely right. This was a TV show. It was not aimed at the hardcore gamers. It was aimed at kids who had vaguely heard about D&D and were curious about it and would have a very rudimentary introduction to it. But it really wouldn't go into detail as to what the game was about. And Gary recognized it as, well, it's a nice additional source of income. We can promote some of our class types, character types, some of the creatures and the types of adventure we have, but we don't have to get so tied up in it that it restricts anything we do anywhere else. So I'm sure he looked over it to make sure that we did nothing that violated the basic principles of D&D, but you know, once you have somebody like Steve Gerber in charge, you know it's going to be a good show.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And so, you know, you got good artists, you got good writers, you got a good story editor. The producers knew what they were doing. It was a very smooth process as far as Gary was involved. I obviously can't speak about every single episode that was done, but I can say I had no connections, no feedback for my episode from him about what was done. So obviously nothing rang any alarm bells.
During this time frame when you were writing this D&D cartoon, were you working on G.I. Joe at the time, or were you unattached from that?
No, this was a step between Ruby Spears and G.I. Joe.
Right, okay.
And with G.I. Joe, I also came in thanks to Steve Gerber. Just very, very briefly so we can get back to D&D.
Yeah,
Steve knew I had been in the Army for 6 years. The first two G.I. Joe miniseries written by Ron Friedman. Ron did a great job. He's really good with character, with dialogue. Not so good with military parlance, military organization, and pretty fanciful when it came to, you know, how weapons are used. I mean, if you remember in the first G.I. Joe serial, he's got jets swooping down to slice tanks in half with their wingtips.
Yeah.
It doesn't quite work that way.
Nope.
But, you know, Steve recognized that I had some knowledge, you know, military knowledge, having been in the Army for 6 years. He asked me to take a look at a couple of the scripts he was working on. I basically corrected a few of the obvious errors, like, you know, sergeants barking orders at colonels and, you know, wrong use of military nomenclature and stuff like that. And I also gave him some pointers on how military units were organized and run. And Steve contacted Hasbro and said, look, you know, Buzz is really knowledgeable. He'll help me make the show look more realistic. And they said, yeah, you know, bring him on. They gave me a tryout script. Haul Down the Heavens was the first one I did for him. And as soon as I turned Haul Down the Heavens in, they offered me a staff position. And then I was, by the end of the first season, I was an assistant story editor, and I was the story editor of the second season.
Okay, cool. So another question we have is, what character did you want to see developed a little bit more on the D&D cartoon, or maybe spend more time with on the show? I mean, out of all of them.
Wow, that's a good question, and it is difficult to answer at this point in time, because what I may have thought back then does not necessarily reflect what I'm thinking now, because there's, like, you know, 30, 40 years of time has passed, and I've had time to, you know, you grow, you change opinions, you look at stuff, and you realize, this might have been a better thing. At the time, probably, and forgive me for drawing a blank here, the little boy character, the little boy barbarian.
Bobby.
Bobby. He was so much fun because he's clearly wants to be Conan, and he's just a little kid.
Yeah.
And so the humor of, you know, the little kid, you know, acting like Conan, that was very much an appeal to me. And if I was going to do a second one or something like that, or if I was told, pick any character to focus on, Bobby probably would have been it. But, you know, later on, the young African-American girl, I would have gone, you know,
Diana,
this is interesting. She's got a cultural background that is different from the traditional Northern European background that D&D originally drew from.
Right.
And yes, D&D incorporates now all sorts of creatures and cultures from all around the world. But when it started out, I mean, it was basically medieval European knights against dragons.
Yeah.
And if I was asked to do something, I would say, well, let's explore that character. Let's see how she reacts and feels being in a world where she, you know, this is not her background. She's got to adjust to this. That might be an interesting story to follow. 20 years from now, I might have an entirely different character that I would want to do. So that's the only fair answer I can give at this time.
No, that's fair enough. Time has passed. Change your mind. You never know.
Yeah.
Speaking along those lines, Chris wanted to know if you could, let's say Hasbro came to you today and Wizards of the Coast and said, hey, we're going to reboot the D&D cartoon from the 80s to help sell the property to younger kids again. We're going to put it on, I don't know, our streaming service or Cartoon Network, whatever. We want you to do that. How would you reboot this cartoon? Would you take the same premise, or would you maybe change it around? Or
That is a great question, and it would take a lengthy meeting just to understand what the objective was before I could even start developing an idea. Because if I were to sit down with someone and they say, we want to reboot D&D, my first question would be, what do you envision when you say reboot D&D? If you are saying, we want to have a show that will go out under the banner name of D&D, it will have the classes of characters, it will have the types of adventures, but it doesn't have to have any connection past that with the original animated show, great. We've got a brand new conversation. We can start a brand new thing here. We can do something wholly different. If you come back to me and say, we want to take those characters and do a new show with them, I've got a couple of ideas. The first one would be, well, how long have they been in the D&D world? Okay. They might be teenagers at this point. They might be young adults. They might be kind of working to the point in their lives where they're starting to realize, we may never go home. This may be home, you know? One of them may find somebody in the D&D world that can't, for whatever reason, can't leave the D&D world, and they now have to make a choice between coming back or staying there. And, you know, that's a different story. That's a young adult story. That's not a little kid story.
No.
On the other hand, if you came to me and said, you know, we want to do something that younger kids, 8 to 10 years old, can easily grasp, jump on, and have tons of fun with, okay, fine, we can go and do that. But then we have to do that in the context of what those kids know about shows like Pokemon, Dragon Ball Z, stuff like that, because you've had since D&D this incredibly rich history of fantasy world characters for all ages. I mean, you've had really grim stuff for older kids. You've had this really lighthearted stuff for young kids. You've had stuff all the way in the middle. It's not the same environment. We're not entering the same river, so to speak, that we entered back in the 80s. So I would have to have, you know, if somebody came to me and said, we want you involved and we want you to do it, I would first want to know, what is it exactly that you're wanting to do here? And right. And then from that point, we can work, you know, towards that goal. But we have to first decide what the goal is.
Hmm. Okay. So another person had asked, he wanted to know why Uni? Why the unicorn character Uni? Why was it involved? Why? Most people hated that character, including myself, so.
My guess is at some point in the proceedings, possibly at the same time the amusement park was suggested, somebody at the network said, oh, wow, and they could have like a cute little unicorn pony following them around. Yeah, okay, sure. We'll be happy to include a cute little unicorn pony. Because the cute little unicorn pony doesn't undermine the show. It doesn't keep the show from being Dungeons and Dragons. It may be, for some people, a little irritating, but for other people, it's like, oh, that's the most darling thing in the world. All right, you know, if you don't like Uni, we understand that. Just, you know, Uni's shtick doesn't last very long. They'll be gone in a moment, and then, you know, we're back to the adventure.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, it's like watching, you know, a sitcom that has like 30 people in the cast, and everybody has to come in at least once an episode and say their catchphrase and then leave.
Right.
And you're going, you know, oh, Uncle Dingleberry. All right, hurry up, Uncle Dingleberry. Say your catchphrase. Great, thank you. Get out of here. Okay, now I can enjoy the rest of the show. It's like that, you know.
Yeah, true. Okay. When you were sitting down to write your episode, did they hand down to you about the whole Eric the Complainer? And because obviously he was the voice of the reason throughout the show, as we always say. He was the one always doubting everything. Did they have a certain restriction on you guys, right, that he had to be the complainer of the show? Because back then it was always the complainer was always wrong and had to go along with the group type deal for moral.
As I said, Steve didn't write the Bible, certainly honed it. He honed it with the input from the networks, and if the networks indicated we want a complainer who gets shown up as you shouldn't be a complainer, it would have been included. Yeah, it doesn't necessarily would say that Steve endorse that kind of a concept. Though on the other hand, Steve wrote Howard the Duck, and if you want a complaining, cynical character, you would really have to work hard to find one more cynical and more kvetching than Howard.
True.
There were certain tropes that the networks believed had to be in there. And the, you know, everybody's on the same team and everybody shares the exact same goals and the exact same motives. I mean, one of the things about G.I. Joe that was so liberating when we worked on it, we had like, at one point we had like 70 characters on the Joe team alone that we could draw from.
Yeah.
And when you have that many characters, you can have conflicting motives. I mean, you know, Shipwreck, Gung-Ho, and Lifeline might all be on the same mission, but they all have different motives why they're on it. They all have different things that's driving them. And it made the show more interesting because it wasn't lockstep. You know, it was more of the real give and take that people have in real life.
Cool. All righty. One question here someone wanted to know, and you may not know the answer to this, but who does hold the rights to the Inhumanoids? Reason why this does come up is because IDW, the comic book company publisher, attempted to do a shared universe with all the Hasbro properties, which they have been doing in the past with Transformers and G.I. Joe and Mask, and they were going to do Inhumanoids, but they suddenly dropped Inhumanoids out of nowhere because apparently Hasbro did not own the rights to Inhumanoids. Do you know who may own those rights?
Short answer is no, I don't know for certain who owns the rights. Slightly longer answer would be, I would presume Hasbro owns or has claim to the underlying rights to the characters, but it's entirely possible at some point they sold off the comic book rights to somebody else, and then they lost track of who had those rights.
Ah.
And this is the shocking thing. This happens a lot more than people realize, but there are any number of properties out there that you say, well, why aren't they making a movie about this? Well, why aren't they making a movie about that? And it turns out there's like three or four competing claims as to who has the rights to make the movie. I mean, let me give you the classic example of this.
Okay.
The James Bond movie, Thunderball.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the 1950s, this agent, gosh, I'm drawing a blank now. I'll remember his name in a moment. But anyway, this agent approached Ian Fleming and said, why don't we write a brand new James Bond adventure just for the screen, just an original James Bond screenplay. And so they hired a screenwriter, a guy named Jack Whittingham, and the three of them sat down and they brainstormed a bunch of ideas, and they finally came up with the basic concept of Thunderball. You know, Whittingham wrote the spine of the screenplay, basically. Fleming contributed ideas. He refined the dialogue and stuff like that. And then they tried to sell it. It was going to be called James Bond of the Secret Service. And they got nowhere with it. Nobody was interested in James Bond at that time. Okay, so they forget all about James Bond. That project dies. In fact, I'm going to pull down Thunderball. You're lucky. I just happen to have my original paperback of Thunderball here.
Wow.
And let me look in the title page here. But anyway, they forgot all about it. And then Fleming sold the rights to the James Bond novels. Well, no, excuse me, I'm missing a step here. Fleming, after all this work, decided he didn't want to waste all the effort that he had put into this. So I've got a really old paperback, and I'll tell you why in a moment. He decided he would just turn it into a novel. So he turned everything they had done into a novel, including all the brainstorming sessions about the different schemes that, you know, Bond could be fighting. They had come up with like about six different basic ideas. And so there's a chapter in Thunderball where Fleming describes Blofeld's past history. And to flesh it out, he just included all of the ideas that they had brainstormed as previous things that Blofeld had done. So he sells the novel, Thunderball, you know, to his publisher. It gets printed, and he's almost immediately sued by not just Whittingham, but also the producer. I'm going to get you this name here. Now I'm Anyway, so he sells it to Broccoli and Saltzman, the original Bond producers, and they incorporate Blofeld from the very beginning into the Bond series. They incorporate Spectre and Blofeld into the Bond series from the very beginning, even in stories that Blofeld wasn't originally involved in. And then the agent shows up and says, wait a minute, you can't do that. I own this. And sure enough, he had a piece of paper that had the Kevin McClory, that was his name. That was the agent's name, Kevin McClory. Okay.
Right.
So McClory shows up and says, I've got a contract that gives me the rights to shop James Bond to the Secret Service around. And all of these ideas that you're turning into other stories, those are my ideas because they were all generated when I was, you know, putting the project together. So there's a lawsuit about this, and the upshot is they settle with McClory and they say, okay, you will be the producer of record on the movie Thunderball. You're going to get a nice big hunk of money for doing so, even though you're never going to show up on the set, but you're going to get a big hunk of money for doing so. And you will be credited as coming up with the basic idea and so forth and so on. And then we never want to hear from you again. And McClory said, that's fine. So when you see the original Thunderball, Broccoli and Saltzman are the executive producers. McClory is the actual credited producer, even though he was never on the set. Jump ahead several years. Connery is pissed off at Broccoli and Saltzman, quits the Bond series. And McClory shows up and says, I have the right to remake Thunderball as many times as I want, the novel. I want to remake it, and we'll do a brand new one called Warhead, and we'll put you in it, and we'll put Orson Welles as Blofeld. And so they get this project started. And then Broccoli and Saltzman sue them to stop it, and that scares away the initial round of investors. But then by the time they finally hash this back and forth, it is established, yes, McClory has the absolute right to remake the novel Thunderball as many times as he wants, and the novel Thunderball has six other plots in it describing what Blofeld has done. So he had the ability to make six different James Bond movies. And so he brings Connery back, and they do Never Say Never Again, which is, if you've seen it, it's Thunderball. And the concept was they were going to relaunch the series, and they were going to do a brand new James Bond series that would be each one would be one of these plots that Blofeld had come up with. And, of course, everybody blew a gasket at that, and there were lawsuits flying around back and forth. And finally, the Eon Productions, the people who now own the rights to the Bond stories, they finally bought out all the rights completely from McClory, and they also got the rights back to Casino Royale. And so now they have a complete lock on. But you can see there was a period of time where it would have been possible for somebody to have an alternate James Bond series, and it would have been a completely legitimate James Bond series because the rights had been so improperly tracked. I'm guessing something like that has happened regarding Inhumanoids, that somebody has lost track of who controls what rights, and they're basically saying, you know, it's we're not going to see enough money to make it worthwhile to have to answer a lawsuit.
Right.
So just don't do it. And that's my guess as to what has happened there.
Okay. Well, yeah, that probably what happened, and that's why they didn't. They just cut it out. It was like it was just dropped out of nowhere. We were all like, okay. Well, it happens.
It things like that happen because, you know, you get these weird little things that happen. You get deals that get set up, and then the next thing you know, somebody withdraws something from it. I don't know how familiar you are with a comic book series called 1963. Does it ring a bell with you?
No, I don't. I have to look
Okay.
that one up.
Basically, Alan Moore, Stephen Bisset, and a bunch of other top creators came up with their version of the Marvel Universe in 1963. And the series was supposedly six issues of a typical month's worth of publication from this Marvel-like with their Marvel characters. And they were all going to tie in to this one big super adventure, and there was going to be this last double-sized volume that was going to tie everything together, and there'd be this great big huge elaborate story. And then everything fell apart. And Moore withdrew from the project, and because he had come up with the original concept, he could block everybody else from doing what they originally discussed. So the characters belong to the individual creators, but those individual creators can't work with one another to, share adventures with those characters.
Oh, I just found it. I see they changed a lot of the characters around to fit the story. Like the Fantastic Four became Mystery Incorporated, Spider-Man became the Fury, Captain America became USA, and so on and so forth. Okay.
And it was really good. I mean, it really harkened back to the original Marvel era. And everybody was waiting. Yeah, we want to see how you're going to tie this all in at the very end. And, I mean, it was like, geez, Alan, just take one for the team. Don't set the fans up and then yank the rug out from under them.
Well, happens. Alrighty. I think one last question here is out of all the properties or the IPs you've worked on, which one would you're gonna have to put your mind back into the 80s and 90s here. Which one would you have liked to have had your hand more into and written more for out of all the things you've done from, I don't know, Thundar, G.I. Joe, Bionic Six, Visionaries, all the properties you've worked on?
I would have to say G.I. Joe
Okay.
with this proviso. I think we had run out of steam towards the end with Cobra, and I think we needed to reconceptualize what the Joes were doing, what their mission was, and who they were against. I think we could have introduced a new series of villains and threats for them to fight against. I actually was involved with a Hasbro project in the mid-90s that was I developed it for them, and my take was that it was going to be a Tom Clancy-like version of G.I. Joe. It wasn't going to be this big, huge unit. It was going to be a small team that went out and did not fight giant battles, but rather smaller, more like SEAL secret missions, things like this.
Okay.
And it was going to be much more of a, as I said, Tom Clancy type thriller as opposed to a big, massive battle type story. And for a variety of reasons, I was not able to stay on the project. Partially because I was at the same time I was doing this, I was also an editor at Penthouse Comics. And very long story short, I went my way, they went their way, and Penthouse Comics went its own way. So,
Was that
but
G.I.
if
Joe
of all of
Extreme
them,
that you worked on, or
excuse me?
was that G.I. Joe Extreme you're talking about, or okay.
Yes, G.I. Joe Extreme.
Gotcha.
The pilot and maybe the second and third episodes have a little bit of what I was trying to do in them. And then after that, they just went off on their own direction. And okay,
Right.
I have this thing. And when people ask me, what would you like to do? And this, that, and the other thing, I have learned when I'm done with a project, I put it down and I walk away from it. And people will ask me, well, what do you think about what they've done with Transformers. And I say, I can honestly say I've made no effort to watch Transformers after our show. I've seen, you know, one or two stray episodes. I wish people well who work on it. Everybody who likes what was done after we worked on it, more power to you. I deny nobody their pleasure.
Right.
But I'm not going to sit there and go, oh, they shouldn't have done that, or they shouldn't have done this, or, oh, I wish we had done that first. I mean, there's no point to that, in my opinion. So we did what we did. It's done. I put it down, and I walked away from it. And that's why when you ask questions like, well, if you were going to reboot D&D, or if you were going to do this or that, the answer invariably comes down to, well, I have to talk with whoever is talking, you know, what exactly is it you want to do? Because I'll be very honest with you, if you wanted to try to exactly duplicate the zeitgeist, as they would say, of the world that existed at the time we did Dungeons and Dragons,
yeah,
that's 30 years ago. Okay, 35 years ago, the world has changed, points of view have changed, the way stories have been told have been changed. If you tried doing it exactly that way, it would come across a little bit simplistic today, because we have changed the way we tell stories. We've changed the way we accept stories. Our understanding of the world and people in it and whatnot has changed as well. So I'm trying not to be, you know, difficult here, but it's very hard for me to answer a question like that, because, you know, if
that's why I was saying
things have changed. Yeah, things have changed, you know.
That's what I was thinking. If you were still in the mind frame of, you were in the 80s and 90s, which project would you have liked to just continue on a little bit more? And you said G.I. Joe, so.
Yeah, well, because G.I. Joe I had the most fun with. G.I. Joe I understood because I had a little bit of a military background. G.I. Joe because I love Shipwreck as a character, and I just, you know, anything I could do. But recently, they got rid of the Kindle Worlds program that they were doing at Amazon. Kindle Worlds was basically a way to write fan fiction,
yes,
and get paid for it.
Yes.
And I had this G.I. Joe story that I had developed that never got made into an episode. And I thought, well, let me just do this as a novel. I'll put it up there and I'll make some money off of it. And and I wrote The Most Dangerous Man in the World, which is the, you know, it's not available anymore. Sorry. But it took me a long time to get back into the G.I. Joe mind frame. I mean, I had to go online and research it. I had to read the characters' bios. I had to read, you know, all the weaponry and everything and get familiar with it again. And it was easy to do it when we were writing it because, you know, if we're writing G.I. Joe and somebody says, hey, you know, is Roadblock a Rhodes Scholar? He is now. Type, 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 you know. And then it's just like, you know, if we need him to be a Rhodes Scholar, son of a gun, he's a Rhodes Scholar. How about that?
Yeah.
You can't do that with legacy characters that have been established and people now know who they are and they've been set in stone basically for generations, literally generations. I've had people, you know, bring their grandkids up to me and the grandkids are saying, you know, yeah, my grandfather told me how much he liked the show when he was a kid and I'm watching it now and I'm going, oh my God, do I feel old?
Yeah. Both feel old. I feel old now too, thinking about it, and I'm not that old. But I was I was your target audience back then, so you can get my age there. But you know,
yeah.
I still look at it now, and I still, like, every once in a while, if there's G.I. Joe on the TV or on the apps I'm watching, I'll sit there and watch it because, you know,
yeah,
reminds you of the time. So
yeah, I begrudge no one their pleasure. I mean, you know, you watch something as a kid, it sinks in, it registers with you. We had the grandkids over on Labor Day weekend.
Right.
And, you know, they were watching their shows. And I said, let me show you what I watched when I was a kid, when I was a little younger than you were. And I put on an old Jerry Anderson Super Marionation show, Fireball XL5. And they're going, but you can see the strings. And I said, well, it doesn't matter. And he said, but you can see the strings. And I said, it didn't matter. It was just a story. But you can see the strings. They couldn't get past the strings. They just kept focusing on the strings on the puppet, you know?
Well, yeah, I know one of my friends, his kid is now just getting into He-Man, the original He-Man that we watched in the 80s, and she's all enthralled with it, loves it, and sits there and watches it, and has no problem with it. But, you know, some kids look at it and go, I can't stand this animation, you know, I don't know.
Yeah.
Some kids are snobs.
Well, I mean, I could understand certain things, because, I mean, I'm not to say, because I started at Filmation Studios. And man, if there was ever a studio that knew how to budget on an eyelash, I mean, my goodness,
a shoestring,
you would work on a show at Filmation, and you're a writer, and they'd come in and they'd hand you these big notebooks of stock shots that they had of Tarzan running or Fat Albert doing something. And they'd say, when you write the scripts, go through here and call out as much stock animation as you can, because we can reuse this stuff is just sitting on the shelf and we can reuse it for anything we need it for. And so, you know, you watch some of these shows and you'll notice there's an awful lot of scenes of characters running back and forth or just talking, you know, and things like that. They could animate that stuff real easy, you know, because they had all the stock footage.
Oh, yeah, like the ones of He-Man just turning to the left and just running, things like that. Oh, yeah, I got it.
Yeah, I did one Brave Star for them.
Yes.
And they gave me the entire series, you know, as a thank you for, you know, they paid me, but they also gave me a copy of the entire series on DVD. And I have never, ever watched any episode of Brave Star except for mine. And the reason I haven't is because if I watch mine, I'm not aware of how much stock animation is in it. And right. So I'm going, hey, you know, that was actually a pretty good episode. I like that. You know, if I saw two or three, I might go, son of a gun, they only did like 20% new animation.
Well, yeah, that's how Filmation worked back then. So.
Yeah.
All right. Is there any, to wrap this up, because I know you got to get going. Is there anything you're working on right now you can tell us about, or any projects you have coming out?
I'm working on tons of stuff. I have a novel, young adult novel completed called Poor Banished Children of Eve that will be out very soon, I promise you. I mean, the book is actually finished. It's just the technical setup part now. I'll have another book coming out very shortly after that. I have several short stories out there circulating around, and people who visit me on Facebook or at my blog, www.buzzdixon, B-U-Z-Z-D-I-X-O-N, all one word, .com. I will be touting this stuff. In fact, I've got a book signing. If you're in the Santa Clarita area on September 8th, show up at the open bookstore, and I've got a book signing going on. So